If Jesus came to this world again today, as he came before, as a baby in a manger, I am nearly convinced that again we would kill him. If he spent time in our high schools, our high schoolers would eventually want to be rid of him. If he came to our place of employment and spent much time with the employees, it would not be long before those employees would want to kill him. Even if he came to our church and spent weeks with us, unless for many of us there was a great change of heart and mind, we would soon want him to leave. And I believe that men and women would kill him today for the very same reason they killed him the last time he came. It is because he is holy. He is holy. Holiness disturbs us. Holiness threatens us. Holiness disqualifies us. When Jesus was here before, his presence eventually evoked one of two responses, either hostility or humility. Indifference was not one of the options. For when people saw him for who he truly was, when he was here in person, he did not allow them to be indifferent. They were given only the options of hostility or humility. Now I have taken on today, once again, the task of describing the indescribable, the ineffable, the inexpressible, describing the holiness of Jesus. I am certain it would be easier to describe a sunset to a sightless man than to describe the holiness of Jesus. Why is it difficult to describe a sunset to a blind person? Because you have no common ground, you have no common language with which to speak. So it is in describing the holiness of Jesus. We are talking about an attribute of Jesus that is so different from anything we experience that we have no language to describe it, no common ground to understand it. The holiness of Jesus is something we are able to experience, I think, more readily than define. But I need to give you two words today that I hope you can hang your thoughts on for the day that will help us as we look at how people experience the holiness of Jesus. The two words are transcendence and purity. In describing holiness, then, I would describe it as pure transcendence and also transcendent purity. I hope to make better sense of that as I proceed. The word transcendence, then, first of all, simply means to climb across. It has to do with exceeding the limits, the usual limits. To transcend is to rise above the limit of knowledge. It is to rise above the limit of experience. When we speak of the transcendence or the holiness of Jesus as his transcendence, then, we are talking about Jesus in terms of how far above us he is. How beyond us he is, how different from us, how foreign to us, his transcendence. Look with me, please, at Luke chapter 8. I'd like you to follow along in your Bible or on the screen with the description of what happened when Jesus showed up on a particular occasion. The passage is familiar to many of you, but think of it, please, in light of this transcendence of Jesus. Luke chapter 8, beginning at verse 26. They, that is Jesus and his disciples, sailed to the region of the Gerasenes, which is across the lake from Galilee. When Jesus stepped ashore, he was met by a demon-possessed man from the town. For a long time, this man had not worn clothes or lived in a house, but had lived in the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell at his feet, shouting at the top of his voice, "What do you want with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torture me." For Jesus had commanded the evil spirit to come out of the man. Many times the spirit had seized him, and though he was chained hand and foot and kept under guard, he had broken his chains and had been driven by the demon into solitary places. Jesus asked him, "What is your name?" Legion, he replied, because many demons had gone into him, and they begged him repeatedly, that is, begged Jesus, not to order them to go into the abyss. A large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside. The demons begged Jesus to let them go into them, and he gave them permission. When the demons came out of the man, they went into the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and was drowned. When those tending the pigs saw what had happened, they ran off and reported this in the town and countryside. Now, I want you to stop for just a moment and consider with me, again, what has just taken place. And now I want you to see how the people respond to Jesus at that point in time. Reading on. And the people went to see what had happened. When they came to Jesus, they found the man from whom the demons had gone out sitting at Jesus' feet, dressed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. They were afraid of what they saw. And in their fear, what do they ask Jesus to do? Reading on, verse 36. Those who had seen it told the people how the demon-possessed man had been cured. Then all the people of the region of the Gerasenes asked Jesus to leave them because they were overcome with fear. So he got into the boat and he left. Why were they so afraid? Because they experienced the presence of holiness. Something told them they were standing in the presence of the transcendent one. This was a person and a power beyond their ability to comprehend. Here was a man so different, so other, that their natural response was fear. About 60 years ago, Orson Welles broadcast the radio program called War of the Worlds. I suspect many of you have read of it. It was a fictional account of the invasion of New Jersey. Why New Jersey? I have no idea. But the fictional account of the invasion of New Jersey by Martians. Now, so realistic was that presentation, so convincing was Orson Welles in his oratory, that people thought it was for real. Do you remember from your textbooks? How did they respond? Panic. Great fear. In fact, it's reported that one man literally took up a gun and was seen driving to where this incident was supposed to be happening because he was going to kill the Martians. Martians were so totally foreign in the minds of those people that they could perceive and conceive of nothing but fear in response. To the Gerasenes of Galilee, Jesus was so completely different, so uniquely other, so transcendent that he did not fit any category that they had, even of God. They were in the presence of the Holy. Rudolf Otto, a theologian of a past generation, coined the phrase mysterium tremendum, the awesome mystery. He said, there is a vague, incomprehensible something in the universe, surrounding the universe, and experienced in the heart of every person. There is a sense that there is something uncreated, a presence that is outside our experience. In all human nature, there is this instinct that there is something besides us. To the animist, to the Muslim, even to the non-religious religions of the world, it is that mystery that drives them. According to the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 1, all people have instinctually a knowledge of the existence of God, some sense of that awesomeness, the awesome mystery. But, Paul tells us, instead of bowing in humility before that God, they refuse to acknowledge him as he is and instead exchange the truth of God's transcendence for a lie, and they create their own God, one they can manage. Did the Gerasenes believe in God? I am certain they did. I believe that they worshipped, but they had their own concept of God. And this one who stood before them was very different from their concept. Their God, they worshipped in a certain way, I am certain, and apparently their God left them alone to lead their lives the way they wished to lead them. They created God in their own image. I hope you catch the play on words. They created God in their own image. And they had then had a God who they believed would help them fulfill their goals. Actually, their God, like most people's gods, was just simply a larger-than-life human being. A little bigger, a little stronger, a little wiser than themselves. But when those Gerasenes met Jesus, the Holy One, the Transcendent One, they were terrified. They were afraid because He was the awesome mystery. He was unique. He was wholly other. And He did not fit their categories. They stood in the presence of this holy, transcendent God, and His presence disqualified their God. His presence disqualified their beliefs. His presence disqualified the way they lived their lives. That's why I said earlier that if Jesus were to come again today as He came before, I believe that in this world today we too would kill Him. We like our concept of Jesus. We like our caricature of Him. Because the Jesus that many people have in mind is a mild-mannered Clark Kent type who makes Himself available when we need Him to help us out of the jams that we put ourselves in, but otherwise, and this is important, otherwise He stays out of the way. We like the baby Jesus in a manger. We like a baby, like a Jesus who died for us and went back to heaven and prays for us and largely leaves us alone. But that's a caricature. That is not the Jesus of the Scriptures. That is not the Jesus who was born in the manger. That is not the Jesus who today reigns supreme. The real Jesus is holy, transcendent, wholly other, the awesome mystery, and He cannot be ignored. I don't know how many times, but I know many times, probably like some of you, I have prayed that God would make Himself known to me as He truly is. I have asked God to make His powerful, transcendent, holy presence known to me, even more than He has. But as I've prayed that, I've also been keenly aware there's a part of me that does not want Him to do that. Why? Because I'm afraid. I'm afraid of what it might mean to my attitudes, my lifestyle, my decisions. I'm afraid of what it might mean to life itself for me. To see Him in His holiness, to know Him as He truly is, I think would explode our caricatures, would explode our misconceptions. And I think we too, like the Gerasenes, would be afraid. Exodus chapter 15, verse 11. Who among the gods is like You, O Lord? Who is like You in holiness, awesome glory, working wonders? If Jesus is the holy God, then everything that people believe instead of Him is useless. If Jesus is the awesome mystery, then other gods are simply figments of imaginations. Our caricatures are nothing but hollow emptiness. If Jesus is the transcendent God, then He has a claim on our lives that will not allow us to go on with life as usual. If He is holy, if He is transcendent, then we are at His mercy. For He is sovereign. Is it any wonder the Gerasenes wanted to do away with Him, wanted Him out of the way? Is it any wonder that we in our lives today too often would be hostile toward Him, would want Him gone? It's because He disqualifies our assumptions. He disturbs our lives. His very presence demands a change. When Leonardo da Vinci was about to depict the face of Jesus in that famous painting, eventually to become famous painting, The Last Supper, it is said that before he painted the face, he spent time in prayer and meditation. But even so, when he finally picked up the brush to give visual expression to the face of the transcendent Lord, it says that his hands trembled. Well, they should. Today we are in the presence of a transcendent Lord Jesus. And it calls us to humility. Of Charles Lamb, the English writer, it is written, Yes, I said it right. Of the writer, it is written. One time, having some fun with some friends, the question was asked how the others thought they would feel if some of the great personages of the past were to all of a sudden appear in their midst in the flesh. But one of the men asked this question, and what if Christ were to enter this room? At that, it is written, Lamb's countenance changed. And as was often the case when he was deeply moved, he stuttered his response. He said, you see, if Shakespeare entered, we should all rise. But if Jesus appeared, we must kneel. That raises the second characteristic of Jesus' holiness. I've spoken of his transcendence. I speak now of his purity. Something very interesting. There is a moral excellence about Jesus that even the most severe critics of Christianity find themselves not critical of Jesus. Interesting indeed. Those who are most overt, blatant, those who are the loudest in opposition to Christianity are complimentary of Jesus. Why? His purity, his moral excellence is the source, I believe, of that uncommon respect. Sin is universal. It is the deep, dark mystery of human existence. It is the stumbling block to reason. It is the problem of problems. It is the source of all misery. And many, if not all people, are willing to admit their defects. They're willing to admit their folly and their foibles. At least they're willing to admit it in some general kind of way. But in Jesus, we have the one solitary and absolute exception to the universal nature of sin. Jesus never sinned. Too often when we think of holiness, we think of a life that is dull and inactive. We think to be a holy person, an individual must withdraw from life as it really is. In the very enjoyable Christmas story, the greatest Christmas pageant ever, which I'm sure many of you have read, the little girl selected each year to be the Mary in the church children's Christmas pageant had to be, she was told, a little girl who was looking pure. They would put Vaseline on her eyelids and she would stand perfectly still, looking absolutely serene as if from another world. That's our concept of holiness, withdrawn from reality. But Jesus immersed himself in the affairs of life. He was not inactive like some monk in seclusion. Jesus was involved in the life of the masses. He went from before sunrise to late in the day, hiking and preaching and teaching and healing and counseling and defending. He spent hours with his slow-to-learn disciples. He was ridiculed. He was defamed. He was abandoned by those into whom he had poured his life. He was physically and emotionally drained time and time again, but he never, never spoke a word that had to be modified or retracted. Not one half-truth, never an exaggeration. No misstatements were ever uttered. He never regretted a single thought. Never had to apologize for a single action or word. Never shed a tear in repentance. Never had to confess sin or ask forgiveness. In fact, he invited his enemies to find even one thing of which they could rightly accuse him. He never retaliated in word or in thought, even when he was ruthlessly attacked and scandalously slandered. Here was a man who felt and thought and acted and spoke and suffered and lived and died, surrounded by sinners, every one of them. And yet never was he contaminated with sin. His disciples who knew him best never charged him with sin. I love this. They never found an inconsistency between what he said and what he did. Not one inconsistency. Perfect integrity. Preaching great morality is very different, we all know, than practicing great morality. They are two very different things. Moses was the great lawgiver. but he was smeared with guilt. David was the one who sang so many songs and wrote them about holiness, but he was himself the greatest of sinners. But Jesus did what he taught. Whether he was with his family or with the sick, whether he was with his adversaries or the disciples, whether he was with the rich or the poor, he was always the same. He was at 12 in the temple, the same person he was at 33 on the cross. And when he came to the end of his life, he could pray these words to his Father, "Father, I have accomplished your will perfectly." Was that obnoxious pride or arrogant hypocrisy? No. Because the facts substantiate the claim. In him there was no sin. Now it is that purity which makes him so attractive. But it is also that purity that makes us so hostile. I earlier said that if Jesus came to this earth again the way he came the last time, we would kill him. The question is why? It's because his perfection and his purity stands in such sharp contrast to our sinfulness that we cannot stand it. Nor can we stand him. I want you to imagine, silly as it is, that Prince Charles is visiting our city. And in the midst of his touring, he decides to spontaneously stop at the home of a commoner. And yours happens to be there. You're in your backyard, dressed in a pair of old shorts and a dirty t-shirt that you don't want to be caught dead in, when all of a sudden you hear one of your own children coming out the back door, and in tow is the Prince of Wales. And there you are, one of the most self-conscious people on the face of the earth at that moment. You feel conspicuous, you feel ashamed, you feel more than a little embarrassed. Many of you know the story of Peter and the other disciples when they were fishing all night and they caught nothing. The next morning, Jesus, standing on the shore, asked if he could board the boat. He does. They move back out into the Sea of Galilee, and Jesus suggests that in contrast to where they have been fishing, they fish on the other side of the boat. And to their utter amazement, they catch so many fish they can hardly haul them into the boat. If you know the story, you also remember that something happened to Peter in that moment. In that moment, he has a flash of insight that apparently he had never had before, at least in the same way. Something happened in that incident that triggered in Peter a new awareness of who Jesus truly was and is. Standing in the presence of Jesus in that smelly fishing boat, Peter instantly felt self-conscious, instantly felt embarrassed and conspicuous and ashamed. Standing in the presence of perfection, Peter saw himself as he'd never seen himself before. It was as if the bright light of purity was all of a sudden illuminating him. And every sinful thought, every evil action, every imperfection was instantly, brightly exposed. Peter was seeing himself for the very first time. And when he saw himself, his response is very appropriate. In fact, the first part of it is exactly like the Gerasenes. "Depart from me, Lord. Get away. Go away." But the next part is different. "For I am a sinful man." I once received a letter from a woman that was to me incredibly sad. A woman wrote to me telling me of her pain, of feeling like she was standing in the very presence of Jesus with all of the sin of an unbreakable habit. She said that she repeatedly confessed her sin with tears of anguish only to find herself going back again and again into that same immoral conduct. And as I read her letter, I felt the turmoil and the torment of her soul. I have experienced that. She said that she would rather die than keep going on as she was. She said that if she could simply convince herself that what she was doing wasn't all that bad, she'd be okay. But she could not get out of her mind the picture of Jesus. And his purity was a constant indictment. And like Peter, there was a part of her that wished Jesus would simply go away, because the awareness of her sin was a pain too great for her to bear, and I have known that same feeling. And I suspect many of you have as well. I am so glad that Jesus did not do what Peter asked him to do. I am so glad that Jesus did not simply go away. Instead, with Peter, Jesus did something quite unexpected. He said to Peter, "Don't be afraid." One difference between Peter and the Gerasenes. Well, they both asked Jesus to get away. They couldn't stand the presence of purity. But Peter confessed his sin and his need. There's the difference. And Jesus forgave him. I was so grateful that I was able to write as one sinner to another sinner and be able to speak Jesus' words to her. Don't be afraid. The same holy Jesus before whom you stand so indicted is the same Jesus who died for the very sin against which you now struggle so deeply. Don't be afraid. He will forgive you. He will help you. As we come to him confessing our need in humility before his transcendence, as we come confessing our need, our great need as we stand before his purity, as we confess our need, he forgives from his great grace, and he will not leave us. You know, Jesus' purity is what makes us keenly aware of our own impurity. But it is also Jesus' purity that makes it possible for us to be forgiven. For he who knew no sin became sin for us, so that we might have the righteousness of God. Purity and transcendence describe the holiness of Jesus. How do we respond to his holiness? A few ways. One can be hostility. Get away. Just get away. Another can be denial, hanging on desperately to our caricatures of who Jesus is, of what holiness is, of what God is all about. Or we can respond in confession and humility. Confession as we stand before his purity, humility as we stand before his transcendence. How do you respond? The Jesus of the manger, the Jesus who is coming again, is the pure, transcendent, holy God. In this Christmas season, it is right that we remember who he is and that we humbly confess our need. Pray with me, please.